That doesn't count.
Correction, you need a technical brush.
Right.
We can edit the video later.
Sure. Let's start very lighthearted then. Maybe a show of hands. Who here has heard of mutation testing? Amazing. I can go very quickly to some slides then. So who has never heard of mutation testing? For who is a completely new concept? So I will cover it for you guys.
That's nice. Of course, I'm here on behalf of like to promote
Stryker a little bit. So who of you is actually using Stryker already? Nobody. One person. Well, it's my colleague. He's also working on it. Cool. So you guys are definitely going to learn some stuff today then. So I can just start, right? Sure. So welcome, everybody, to the talk, How Mutation Testing Got Practical. And I'm really focusing on the got practical in this talk. So I will be explaining mutation testing a bit. But I'm really looking deep into the internals and why is the idea really old? And is the practical use case relatively new? So we'll get into that. But first, a little introduction. My name is Jan-Jelle Kester. I'm a software engineering consultant at InfoSupport. It's a consultancy organization in the Netherlands. I'm also a trainer there, and I'm a research supervisor. And that last one is actually relevant today. You'll hear why soon. If you want to contact me afterwards, the easiest way is LinkedIn, I guess. But you can also find me on GitHub. And as I said, I'm here on behalf of Stryker. And Stryker is a mutation testing framework for JavaScript and TypeScript, C#, Scala, and hopefully at some point Kotlin. There's like a partial implementation there already. We're working hard on it. You can find us at strykermutator.io. And of course, have all these nice socks for you guys. So if you're really good with asking questions and reacting to my questions, you might get some. And otherwise, just see us after. We'll have some more. So in this talk, in this next 25 minutes, because I am going to try to leave room for questions as well, I first want to talk about why do we actually need to understand our tests? Why is just writing a test not good enough? I also want to go into what mutation testing is for the people that don't know yet. And finally, and that's the major part, hopefully if I don't run out of time, I'm going to go deep in how we got to practical applicability, how we got into this state now where we can actually run mutation testing in our real projects. And that means talking about some state of art performance improvements. But first, we have to talk about the false sense of security. Because this is a promotional image I copied shamelessly from the SonarQube website. And they show this nice dashboard where they say, well, everything is good. There's no issues, no bugs, it's all fine. And there's even 76% test coverage. Who would be happy with that? Okay, who wants to say why? Why is 76% good, according to you?
Lots are green.
Large or small socks?
I don't wear socks.
You get some anyway. Oh, sorry about that. They're hard to throw in this room. No, I would say I would not be happy with that. Because, I mean, our tests, apparently, when we're running our tests, we reach 76% of our code. I don't think that's enough. Because there is more than 20% of our code that is not even getting executed while running the test. That's a problem. But even 100% code coverage is actually, it doesn't say much. Because coverage only means that code is being executed. We are only testing, in a worst case scenario, that the program does not crash. What you actually want to know is if our tests do something. And I can very easily get 100% code coverage on a program without writing any assertions. And I'm just checking that the test execution does not crash. So we need a way of testing our tests. And no, we're not going to write unit tests to test our test logic, because that would be stupid. I mean, it would never end. We need to be smart about that, and that's where mutation testing comes in. So what we're going to do is to introduce changes in production code automatically. That's a tool that's doing that. And then running the test again to see whether the tests start failing. Because when the tests start failing, at that point, you know that your tests are actually able to catch that bug that we purposefully introduced. So it's also a form of white box testing, because we really have to know stuff about the internals of the code to change it, and to see whether it, whether the tests are good enough to catch that. And this is really not a new idea, because there's this nice paper from 79 already, where they talk about a new way of, a new type of software test. And you can actually find this on Google, and you can read it if you want. But even back then, 40 years ago, 45 years ago, they were already talking about that. But only recently, and I talk recently in a very broad sense here, because I wasn't even in high school, I think, when I'm talking about recent, it got more traction, because the problem is, in the 70s or late 70s, it was just a good idea. We did not have the resources to actually apply it in practice. And what you see here, the dark colored bars are publications, research publications about practical applicability, and they really spike early this millennium. And there are reasons for that. Mostly also, I think, because our computers got fast enough. And why that is important is because of how mutation testing works, what the process behind it is. Because we start with our source code, and we're feeling very happy about it, of course. Because we made all this nice code. We even wrote tests for it, so we're very confident. And what the tool is then doing is going to introduce mutants in your code. And mutants are just changes. And for every change that is made, the tests are executed again. And we can have two results. Either the tests start failing, which in this case is good, because we then detected that mutant, we found the bug. So we say that mutant is killed, or the mutant survived. And that means that your test is not complete. And when you do that for everything, in the end, we get a nice report out of it. Like a coverage report, except a bit more detailed. And how that process actually works is that there are operators for that. And an operator is basically a transformation. Given a certain thing in your code, what kind of changes can we do that might fail your tests? And some examples are here. There are way more. And also one operator on the left could result into, or one source code, original source code on the left could result into multiple mutants. But you could do like just switch the operators or throw away a whole block of code. And when we do that, for every of these mutants, we measure something, right? So I already talked about killed and survived. But that's only in an ideal scenario, because in practice, there might be code that's not even reached by tests. So you can say, well, we have no coverage, or we have a timeout. And timeout basically means that our mutants cause an infinite loop. And we should consider that, okay, well, infinite loop test actually failed then, so that's maybe kind of killed. But you can also get runtime errors, or compile errors, because we're just introducing weird code changes without looking at what the code is actually supposed to be doing. And finally, mutants can also be ignored, because that's when a developer said, I don't want to test for this, and I don't want to see it in the report anymore. So it's just like suppressing warnings for your code quality checks. Who here does that very often? I do, actually, but... and then, just like with the code coverage score, we want to have a nice metric. We want to know how good we are doing. And for that, we can compute a score. And we call that at Stryker the orientation score. And basically what we say here is we want to express in a nice number on a scale of 0 to 100% how many mutants did you actually manage to kill? So how many unexpected changes in your code are your tests actually catching? And there's this nice formula, but basically what we do here is everything above the line is what we consider that you killed, and everything below the line, so we divide that by everything that was actually a valid change. So we exclude the crashes, for example. And that gives you, for your whole program, for your whole code base, an indication of how good your tests actually are. But what if you don't have that many tests yet? Well, then you can also compute a variant of the mutation score, where you just look at the code that's actually being tested. So you see here that we do not include the mutants without coverage anymore. So one might think, just like with code coverage, we should maybe strive for a high number. We should maybe have 100% mutation coverage, 100% mutation score. That would be nice. But there we actually run into a problem, because we cannot actually kill all the mutants. It's very easy, well, relatively easy at least, to reach all your code, so to make sure all your code is getting executed, so basically to get 100% code coverage, that's relatively simple. But because you're still calling functions from the outside, you might not be able to test every single operation happening inside of these functions. And actually, some mutants are, if you split up your whole code base completely, you can never kill them. And some, one category of these is equivalent mutants, which is also a problem. So given this code, we have a nice for loop, and we say, well, we want to iterate 10 times. You can also write like this, and it will still work. So this mutant we cannot kill, because even though we changed our code, semantically, it's doing the same thing. So that's where you might want to use ignore, basically. And mutation testing is also very challenging. And that's actually where that practical application problem comes in. Because you can imagine that mutation testing, basically changing your code and then running all the tests again, that can take a lot of time. And if you have a very large code base, that might actually not finish in a reasonable time. You also need a lot of configuration. The mutation testing tool needs to know stuff. It needs to know how it can run tests. It needs to know how it can verify that those tests did complete successfully or not. It also needs to know stuff about your programming language, for example, in order to make sure that it rewrites the code in a correct way. So there also needs to be a lot of tooling support to make it work. And for a long time, mutation testing was simply not feasible or not easy to do. But we're bridging the gap. Not we specifically at Stryker, a lot of stuff has already been done, lucky for us. But when we're looking at performance, this is basically the worst case scenario. So that's the time it takes to run a single mutant, to analyze a single mutant, is basically the time it takes to run all your test cases. So we can approximate it by saying, well, let's just count the number of tests that you have. And then the time it takes to mutate your whole program is just the sum of that. So it basically means that you multiply the number of test cases that you have in your code times the number of mutants that you need to check, because mutants need to be checked in isolation because they can influence each other. So you can imagine already with a very small program, this number, the time approximation, can get really, really, really large. So we need to be smarter about it. We want to make sure that the total time is a lot less. Not just a bit less, a lot less than just that multiplication. And basically there are three approaches to get there. It's either to do it faster. Doing it faster, you for example can think, we're going to parallelize it. We're going to use a lot of cores. Like take a big machine, nowadays it's relatively simple to get a machine with 128 cores, so we can do 128 things at the same time. You can try to do fewer, so you can maybe try to make smart choices and say, well, certain stuff we maybe don't need to analyze because we kind of know that it's probably fine. Or you can try to do it smarter. And the study I referenced here, they really did an analysis on that, like a literature review. And most of the studies are actually focusing on fewer or smarter. And common techniques there, some are listed here. I won't have time to go into detail on all of these. But you can think out like random mutation, like we're just randomly checking stuff sometimes. We're just randomly picking some mutations that we're going to do. But that's not deterministic. So that might not give you the best knowledge about what the quality of your test actually is. Parallel execution, I already mentioned. You can also do stuff like data flow and control flow analysis and try to reduce the set that way. Or maybe look at AI to try to pick smarter sets of stuff that you're actually going to check. But if you want to use that mutation score as a benchmark, as a comparison, for example, with a pull request, did you actually improve it or not? Or to give you a good indication of how good your tests currently actually are, you actually need to execute everything. So just the approach of we're just going to run less, that doesn't always work. And one big way how this process can be sped up is by looking at how we actually change the code. So a very naive approach would, for example, be just changing the source code, running the compiler again, running the test again, and then making another change in the source code, and then running the compiler again, running the test again. And if you have a compiled language with a very slow compiler, that's quite problematic, because then it gets really, really slow. A bit better might be bytecode mutation. So, for example, the JVM languages have bytecodes. They have an intermediate step. Maybe you can mutate that. And then you only have to compile the source code once, and just change the bytecode and then run it. And while that is a lot faster, it's also a lot more complicated, but it has one big downside, and that is that every change that is possible in the bytecode is not necessarily something you can do in your source code, especially for Java, for example. If you write Kotlin or Scala, there's a lot of a very simple thing in Scala, for example, can result in a lot of bytecode, and if you're trying to mutate that with the assumption that the Java compiler compiled it, it might come up with mutants that you did not kill, but you cannot actually kill them because they don't exist in your source code. So who thinks, who has an idea how we can do this smarter? Any ideas? Yes?
Are your steps?
Sorry, what did you say?
You compile all the different mutants in the same executable.
Yes.
And you select which mutant you get one at a time.
Exactly. Large or small socks? Large or small socks? You have socks with a logo on it. Large. Oh, this the larger of the other ones, right? Oh, sorry about that. Thank you, Nico.
For testing good device.
I didn't test my own system, no. Should have written a software to do this. So the answer that was given was basically this. And we call that mutant schemata. And this just makes sure that you compile all the mutants into your code once, and then use an environment variable to just switch them on or not. So if you do this, your compiled code is just full of if statements that just check a certain number. And that is complicated, but it is manageable. It's not that hard. The main problem is in keeping track of it, but if you assign every mutant a unique number, you should be fine. And this really helps with compiled languages, especially with stuff that's a bit slower, like Scala. And this is actually relatively new. In the world of mutation testing, this is relatively new. It is from 1993, though, so it's the same age as me. I wouldn't say that I am relatively new, but and something else smart that you can do is coverage analysis. That's also something that has been part of Striker for a long time already. So we actually do an initial run where we just check which tests are reaching what code. So we also know if you change one part of the code, which tests actually need to run and which don't. So you can also get that number of test cases down a lot, depending on where you mutate the code. Some code you don't really know. So if you have something static, for example, a static string defined somewhere, that you might not be able to figure out how that is used. So that might, you might still need to have to run the whole test suite, but you try not to. Something else you can do is incremental analysis. So just try to diff some previously stored state and try to guess which mutants you actually need to check. This is very hard to do fully foolproof, fully complete, but you can get there like 99%. And that means that if you make a small change, a small pull request, that checking whether your changes are tested properly is relatively simple, is relatively fast. So if Nico here up front, he gave a talk yesterday in the JavaScript dev room, and he actually showed this feature. And I think that there was a difference between a couple of seconds and like 30 seconds and 3 seconds, something like that, on a small project. Another cool thing is mutation levels. And that's where you actually give the user a choice. Do you care about testing it fully, or do you care about performance? And the choice that the user wants to make can depend on the type of project or the domain. Do you have code where it's really important that every single thing is tested? Or isn't it that important, actually? Do you actually want to spend the time? Or maybe you want to do a quick and dirty but pretty good analysis for every pull request, but you're doing a nightly build where you test it fully. So there's different approaches here. And this is actually something that is researched by one of my colleagues at InfoSupport. He did his master's thesis on it. So it's really cool. But what could be a downside of this approach? Any ideas? Remember, you can get some socks. Yes?
It will take longer to actually find them. I mean, if you just
to a small set of mutations on the other pull request, maybe like your weekly to the full shebang.
Yeah.
You maybe find, oh, I got three paid tests on the weekend, but introduce them on the Monday.
Yeah, so the answer was the feedback loop is a lot longer, basically. So you get, it might take time to find that your tests are not that great. That's a neat one. I have another on the slide, but yeah, another guess. Sorry?
Problem is reducible because you run nightly and...
Yeah. What kind of size fox do you have? Sorry?
Large.
Things too far. Just come get them later. I will put them aside for you. What's your size?
Small.
Ah, damn it. I'm not good at throwing. But yeah, so the mutation score that you compute, if you choose to run other mutants, the mutation score might not be comparable. So you really need to take care of that. And the tool that my colleague actually created analyzes a code base, so that you can do this actually for a specific project. It analyzes the code base, and it analyzes the test, and it's trying to find a nice balance between accuracy and the number of test executions that you need to do. So it tries to see if there are some mutants that we can exclude that will gain a lot of performance, so it speeds it up massively, but doesn't reduce a lot in accuracy. So that's really nice. And you can actually find his thesis online. So if you go to the FOSDEM page for this talk, you can have a link there as well. And very hot off the press, actually. So there is not even documentation for that, and it's not even merged. It's Project Xavier, and that is actually implementing that idea, because it was very theoretical. So actually implementing that idea in Striker for JavaScript. So if you're really interested in how that all works and what decisions they made, I honestly don't know yet myself, go look at the pull request. And it's also a very cool example. Mike's dead. Oh, it's back again. Where a project group from a university, in this case the University of Twente, contributed to Striker in that way, and they actually built this. Documentation, as I said, still to follow. And this is also a very new thing that also a student is currently working on, is to do more analysis on static analysis on the code, to figure out if we can run, in one run of test cases, if we can analyze multiple mutants. But in order to do that, we actually need to make sure that these mutants do not influence each other. So this only works if you know for sure that they don't cancel each other out, or if you can still, given that the test fails, can say with confidence which mutant it was. So this is really, really complicated. Again, I'm not entirely sure on his progress yet, but question. Yeah, so the question is whether modularizing your application would help. And it would help, because if your modules are smaller, then the test runs are also smaller. They take less time. But it also only works if a normal pull request for you, normal change that you want to do, if that's only contained to one module or two modules. But if you split your code up and you still have to change all modules, then it doesn't help. So it might help. But that's also with, like, general, I want to make my CI pipeline quicker. Just make more repos or build less modules. So yeah, that would definitely work. Come grab a pair of socks later. And now it really is time to also start testing your tests. So if you're not doing that, if you're not using mutation testing in your projects already, it's really good now. We can actually use it. There's been a lot of progress in 45 years. We have better hardware, we have process improvements, and actually there's a lot of research going on still to make it actually faster every time. We also have production-ready tooling. There are many great libraries out there. Some of them are more mature than others, some of them are faster than others. Not everybody integrates the same process improvements, for example. But in general, for most popular programming languages, there is a tool available and you can run it in your pipeline. And most of these tools just integrate with the build tool that you expect. They use information that the test runner already gives you. So that's great. Here's an overview of some suggestions. But if you just Google your favorite programming languages plus mutation testing, I'm sure you'll probably the first result will be the right one. So in summary, when we're talking about mutation testing, we're really talking about testing your test, making sure that your tests actually expect what you do. And something, if there's anything, only one thing that you take away from this talk, don't rely on code coverage, please, because it doesn't say anything. And a lot of research has been gone into performance improvements. There's lots of research still being done. There's still always students coming to us interested in contributing to an open source project with research. So there's plenty of open research questions. And it's also applicable now. So if you're maintaining an open source project, at least consider mutation testing, because especially in open source, where there's many contributors, it's a really good metric to get an idea about the quality of the test that somebody wrote for a pull request. If you want to know more of the code implementation details, as I said, my colleague gave a talk yesterday in the JavaScript dev room. It's probably online at some point, so you can go check that out. And that was my talk, so thank you for listening. Exactly 25 minutes as well, so that went great. If there's any questions, yes. Sorry?
How do you determine which expressions to mutate?
Okay, the question is, how do we determine which expressions to mutate? Basically, there's a lookup. So it does abstract syntax tree analysis, and it just checks a certain node, and there's a lookup table to say, okay, if we have this kind of operation, these are the options that we can, these are the mutations that we do. Just there's basically a big mapping file with all the options, and that is probably not complete for every standard library out there. But for a lot of the logic, comparisons, and stuff like that, you can do it pretty complete. Yes? I couldn't hear the last part. Can you repeat that, please? Ah, okay, so the question is, what is the baseline when you start with mutation testing? Right, so if you have a new code base, if you have a green field, and you implement mutation testing from the start, it's actually relatively easy to get high 90% mutation score. When you have an existing project, it's usually very hard. So actually, Striker for JavaScript has a mutation score of around 80%, which is actually pretty good. It's really hard to get very high scores. So it's not very not like covered, but if you're anywhere close to an 80%, you're actually doing pretty well, I think. Yes? Yeah.
Is that something that, how do you know you're not okay with the edge cases? Or, like, is there really, I mean, I can see the mutation for it, but it's like, if you're looking
at the purpose of the mutation. Yeah. So the question is, when the purpose of mutation testing is to make sure your tests are good, so if you're doing selective mutation, how do you know you're not missing something? And actually you don't. You might miss stuff. But the point is, because it can take a really long time, that you have at least the option like, okay, I'm okay with like 80% accuracy if it's half the time. Because that's for me a good balance for some use cases. But yeah, you have to accept that you're missing stuff because you're just not running all the mutants. So the combination of mutation testing and test-driven development. Well, you have to write your test first then, but you can only mutate once the implementation is there. So once your tests are green, then you can check whether you actually did a good job before writing your implementation, which is kind of strange, actually. Right. Yeah. Yeah, so, but that's very nice, actually. So if you have to change your test because of changing requirements and you re-implement part of your code, then mutation testing will check whether your tests are still complete.
Yes.
So that's actually very good, very nice. Yeah. Actually, if you really want to go into that with property-based testing, you're only gonna test like all possible inputs, even though for sure that is correct, but that's not feasible yet. Property-based testing is really hard still. Do we have time for more questions?
4 minutes.
4 minutes, all the time in the world. Up front.
The question, like from your experience currently, if, for example, you have normal unit tests and they run, say, in Scala for 1 minute, how many minutes will they be run using your framework?
So the question is, if I know how long my unit tests run for, how do I know how long mutation testing will take? And there's only one answer. It really depends. Because it really depends why your tests take a minute. But it's going to be a lot longer. It's not going to be 4 minutes or 5 minutes. It's way more than that. The only way to find it out is to just actually run it. Because the problem is it really depends on how many mutations can be generated for your specific code. Because that is what makes it slow. And because of all these optimizations, you cannot really predict how long it will take. I didn't hear that one.
I'm wondering, how do you report the results of your analysis? Can I take an XML file or something like that? Really in Jenkins and Whistlebase?
Yeah, so the question is, how do we report it? And for Striker, and you can go to the talk with my colleague, he went into that in a bit more detail. We have a standardized JSON format. That again. Oh, it's back. So there's a nice dashboard. But go watch this talk and you will know more. Up front, yes.
So you only run one mutation at a time?
Yeah, you have to. If you want to do more, you have to prove first that these will not influence each other. So that, and you need to know that if one test fails, because of which mutant it is.
With coverage,
No, you really have to do data flow or control flow analysis and stuff like that. So that's very, very difficult. But yeah, there's somebody working on it right now. So maybe in half a year's time, we'll have some more to talk about. Yeah, Psych.net already has an implementation for it, but it's not scientifically proven. So we do not know 100% where that's correct, but at least it's at least 95% there. So if that was the last question, if there's any more question, if you want to talk some stuff, I'll be outside in the hall. And if you ask a question, feel free to come grab your socks here up front. There's plenty. Thank you.